We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. So the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Just go to Indeed.com/Blue Wire right now and support our show by saying that you heard about Indeed on this podcast. That's Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This podcast episode is brought to you by Coors Light. These days, everything is go, go, go. It's nonstop hustle all the time. Work, friends, family expect you to be on 24/7. Well, sometimes you just need to reach for a Coors Light because it's made to chill. Coors Light is cold lagered, cold filtered, and cold packaged. It's as crisp and refreshing as the Colorado Rockies. It is literally made to chill. Coors Light is the one I choose when I need to unwind. So when you want to hit reset, reach for the beer that's made to chill. Get Coors Light in the new look delivered straight to your door with Drizzly or Instacart. Celebrate responsibly. Coors Brewing Company, Golden, Colorado.
Welcome to In the Know, the Bourbon Street Shots podcast. Your hosts are Michael McNamara and me, Ryan Schwan. It's all Pelicans, all the time.
Welcome to the podcast. Since our last podcast, the Pelicans have managed to win one game and lose three. A 1-3 record, Michael. I think we should just slit our wrists now and just die. It's over, right?
Man, way to start it off. No, I mean, we are coming back home. Juvenile's birthday is going to be on Wednesday, and we have re-signed, it looks like, for the rest of the season, the immortal Tony Douglas, NBA 2K killer. So I see nothing but positive moving forward.
I mean, Tony Douglas is going to be all the difference in this playoff chase. He's probably going to get, 8 minutes a game?
Any minutes you could take away from Jimmer Fredette and give to literally anybody else on the planet is a plus.
Wow.
I mean, come on. We saw it this week when you tried to put him in a game. It was brutal. Tony Douglas was far more productive in his short stint. So, yeah, I mean, made another upgrade there, another little small Dell move. So I'm ready to get this to rip off a winning streak right here.
Yeah. So I'll be honest, I'm almost past caring whether we make it to the playoffs or not. I mean, that would be a bonus for me. I want to go four games. I'm not even going to make it a big number. Four games with no new injuries. That's it. Four.
Wait, just games? Because this week...
Games.
This week we had an almost unprecedented a guy not even getting injured in the game, but just a walk-through warm-up session doing drills. Our MVP candidate manages to twist an ankle and miss two games in a glorified walk-through. So,
let me specify. I want a four-game stretch where no new injuries are announced whatsoever. How's that? That better?
Yeah, and I mean, we've talked about this and we've joked about it, but I think enough people, I mean, I'm kind of upset about it too, but I'm used to it so much over the years that I don't really delve that deep into it. But, you know, it really is insane. I see Oklahoma City people like ready to set themselves on fire because now they're dealing with this for like the first time and they're crying, woe is me. And I've followed this team for 20 years and it's happened 19 out of the 20 years. If you're in charge, or maybe just looking at it from a fan, writer, whatever, like what do you do this offseason to dive into this? Do you think the problem is, you know, something as extreme as some kind of voodoo curse? Do you think we have guys with just injury-prone bodies? Or, you know, do you think the medical staff is 100% to blame? Like, it's something we joke about a lot, but it really is depressing. And I put up an article yesterday kind of pointing out how little our key guys have played together over the last 2 years. Mm-hmm. And it is the number one thing holding this team back, and it's held this franchise back forever. So, I mean, what in all seriousness would you do, and is this something as Pelicans fans we should just expect to continue in perpetuity?
No, because there are plenty of teams in the NBA who manage to get away with not having these situations all the time. Like, people are foolish to think that you're going to go through very many seasons where you don't have many injuries. Like, you look at the Spurs, and they've had multiple seasons derailed because of injury. Tim Duncan got hurt right before the playoffs when they were trying to repeat 1 year. They've had Manu have tons of injuries at different times. Tony Parker had one bad year with a lot of injuries. A lot of this will happen to you over the course of like 10, 15 years. You're going to have a few bad seasons. But it is ridiculous, the number that the Pelicans get. And I don't like saying this kind of stuff because I don't know what the training staff is, what they do, if they're different from anybody else. So I don't want to say go in there and clean out the training staff, because that seems like a really crappy thing to say about somebody you know absolutely nothing about. But I would say that I would just like to, I just from a karma standpoint, have somebody go out there and say, have Del Demps go out and say, look, injuries have been a real problem. We're going to go out and we're going to spend X dollars on bringing in a couple new people to help try some new things and bring in some new resources and some new fancy machines. And we're going to hook our players up after every game and replace all of their blood with nanites, like something cool. Like, so at least we have a feeling that maybe they're doing it, because I don't know what the hell's going on with this. And I don't want to blame it on the training staff, but at least pretend like there's something happening that might make next year different, because it's every year.
Yeah, I mean, give the players a placebo before every game. I don't know.
Or the fans.
Yeah, I mean, it's something, I mean, you know, in all honesty, we've tried to look as a sight behind the curtain at the medical staff and really haven't been given the thumbs up approval yet by the team. Still hoping to get that. But without that, I just think it's completely irresponsible to try to, you know, figure out or assume or read into things exactly what's going on back there. I mean, the only thing that I could kind of draw upon is that the Saints have tried some kind of revolutionary things and you know, they've looked into doing some things and have actually done some things where I read that they moved their training camp to, Saints fans don't kill me, but it was like Virginia or somewhere where the humidity wasn't as high, because they had done a lot of research and saw, you know, that led to cramps and muscle pulls and yada, yada, yada. So it's just hard for me to believe that if we recognize this is a problem, that the entire organization doesn't as well. And, you know, I would assume that they're doing tons of things about it, but, you know, it's really hard. I mean, no matter what we do this off season, or no matter how strong we finish, I think every single Pelicans fan will have the same exact prediction going in the next year of, well, 53-58 wins if healthy, but in the back of our minds, we're all going to assume that our top players miss 100-150 games combined. And I don't know how you could really get optimistic about this team until you could get two or three seasons of relatively average injury. I mean, I know guys are going to get injured. I don't mind that, but how many games we have a top heavy roster. We have six really good high paid players on this team. How many games do we go?
I'm not gonna let you get away with that real quick though. You say we have a top heavy roster, but we're talking six dudes here. Like,
well, yeah.
How many teams are there out there that don't have like six pretty solid teammates that are on a good team? Like, there's not a lot of teams that like go eight deep of amazing.
I didn't mean that as an insult. I meant that our top six are really, really good.
Okay.
And then from six, I mean, I guess I would say how many teams have the drop off from six to seven that we have.
Okay.
So I didn't mean top heavy as an insult. But I'm just saying we have six guys who are really good, who are quasi all-star level guys. And like, we go into a game with four of them out, and it's always a different four of them. And, you know, I'm just waiting for the game where the opposite happens with the Pelican. When was the last time you remember going into a game and the team we were playing had four amazing players sitting on the bench? Like, you know, fans of the other team must be licking their chops and jumping for joy whenever they see our injury report. I mean, you know, the Clippers were. The Pelicans stayed in that game, you know, down four of their top players and one guy just returning from injury. Oh, and another guy who had to come off the bench for disciplinary issues. So I understand every team has injuries, but I just don't buy that it's to this level. And if it is, it's for one season. It's not literally every freaking season.
Yeah, I mean, that Phoenix game, like, holy cow. Four and a half players of our top six is how I was telling my friend. I just don't even understand what to even like think about this team anymore. And I'm you and I were having a conversation before the podcast. Like, I could probably just go pull excerpts from last year at the end of the season and play them, and we'd be basically saying the exact same thing. I hope that next year when the season comes around, I just hope that Drew Holiday and Ryan Anderson will be healthy. It's like, anyways, we dwell too much on injuries.
Well, no,
we should talk about, like...
Last thing I want to ask you, though, is, like, there is this terminology that's always thrown around of injury-prone. Just in your perspective, looking at it as a whole, you look at our roster, however you would define the word or the term injury-prone, how many guys on our roster would you label injury-prone?
Uh-huh.
The problem is they all are not injury prone before they become Pelicans.
Yeah, Eric Gordon was.
Eric Gordon was injury prone. I mean, because he didn't have a season where he played more than like 64. I think that was his rookie year. So Eric Gordon was always injury prone. I mean, Davis, he just keeps getting all kinds of little injuries, and if that continues, he'll always be like a 65 to 75. Game guy, which could qualify him for that. Although I think of injury prone guys who are, you know, have all these injuries that take him out for 10 to 15 games at a time. Drew Holiday was an Iron Man before he came here, and this is just one real injury that just doesn't heal. I don't know. I would only give Gordon still that label. But if it happens again next year, then I guess we got to start doing it. Like, Ryan Anderson was an Iron Man before he came. I don't know. It doesn't make any sense.
Yeah. Yeah, I would
say... Petr Stojakovic was an... Oh, no, wait. He had a little bit of injury in Indiana. But, whatever.
Yeah, I would still give Gordon that... we have to step back and not think of the last couple months. You have to look at it. I think if you're going to give that player... that label, you have to look at their career in totality. I would still say Eric Gordon, and I would say the next guy up is Anthony Davis if it continues. But I think it's more his style is injury prone. I mean, you think of some of the injuries he got, you know, high-flying alley-oop that he gets pushed in the back and lands terribly. What was it last year? He, like, hit his hand on the rim and broke some finger. And, you know, it's just it's the style of game combined with the fact that he's still young. I mean, he's a college senior right now, you know, and kind of growing into his body. But, yeah, the Drew Holiday thing, I would never call him injury-prone, but you got to believe I'm worried about that injury. Like, the example I use is Bo Jackson. Bo Jackson wasn't injury-prone, but he got an injury that prevented him from ever playing football again. To me, injury-prone is susceptible to multiple injuries in different areas, you know, more susceptible than anybody else. I think Drew Holiday has a problem with one specific part of his body. But like you said before that, he was an Iron Man. My biggest hope, you know, the number one thing I'm hoping for is that we get some good news and even get to see Drew Holiday play before the season ends. I want that so much more than playoffs, but I won't call him injury prone, but I am very worried about that injury affecting him for years to come.
Yeah, and the NBA is littered with a lot of people who have stress fractures that repeat and repeat and repeat. Yao Ming is gone because of it. Then there are some other players as well who've had similar issues. But then there are some that, like Zydrunas Algauskas, I don't know if anybody remembers this. I remember this because it was impacted me in the fantasy basketball world. But Algauskas, you know, had two straight seasons where he basically just broke he had a stress reaction in his foot, and he went and got the plates and the screws put in. And then the next year he had a stress reaction in the same foot, and he went and got the plates and screws replaced. And then he had a 11-year career. So, you know, it is something that hopefully can be resolved. It just might take a little while for them to get it done right.
Yeah,
that's what I can hope for, though, right?
Our own Quincy Pondexter had a stress fracture, and you know, he's come back and he's been all right. But yeah, I guess it depends on where it is. I mean, as far as ending careers, you got Chris Mills. I don't know if many remember him. Eric Montross and Yao Ming were the big guys. You had, you know, a lot of people that got him re-injured. Derek Fisher, though, pulled through it. Marco Yarick had it, and he went on to marry one of the hottest women in the planet. So there's some upside. Brooke Lopez seems to be fine. So I don't know. It's a scary thing, but that's why I'm hoping. I still think that is the most important thing for this team. But I don't like that label injury prone for Drew Holiday. I don't think it'll matter one way or another, the label. I just think it's inaccurate, but I think it's going to be really interesting to see him, you know, and what happens over the next couple of weeks, months, and years. Hopefully the whole issue will be behind him soon enough.
So I want to ask you this. It's kind of been dwelling on my mind. I want to get your take on it. I don't know if you saw, did you read the Tom Haberstraw article on ESPN.com? Where he was making a case for Anthony Davis for MVP because of that new wonderful stat that basically gives you points because you're hitting big shots and you're making the chance of your team winning swing. You know, did you read that?
Yeah, the win probability, yeah.
Win probability. So basically, real quick, just so everybody understands what we're talking about, it's a stat that basically says if there are 1 minute and 30 seconds left in the game and you hit a basket that puts your team up three, your win probability went from, based on historical records, what happened from that point in the exact same situation, went from 52% to 74%. You get a bonus. So you get basically are assigned 23 points or whatever that math is, which I just don't even remember what my numbers were. And so if you miss a shot, and of course that makes your corresponding points go down, and you just add it up over the course of the season, which basically means that anybody who's hitting clutch shots at the end of games, which is when those percentages will swing wildly, those people get huge scores, and the people who are missing them have real major minuses. And Davis is blowing away everybody else. And I think everybody who watched Davis this season, this doesn't come as a surprise. We've seen Davis hit big, big shots at the end of games. But here's the thing. Like, Tyreke Evans is the worst player in the league at that. So we have both the best and the worst. And Bill Simmons, I listen to him. Bill Simmons has been on a little bit of a kick of anti-Monty Williams for probably like 6 months now. Maybe that might be a little long, but he's been kind of starting to hammer him more and more as the season goes on. And what is your take on this? To me, everything that Bill has ever argued really boils down to one thing. Tyreke Evans gets the ball in his hands too much, and he's bad. And then we have a stat that comes out that says Tyreke Evans has the ball in his hands a lot at the end of games, and he's really bad. So do all the ills of this team come from Tyreke Evans? Is he really like, is there a better option?
Tyreke Evans in this role? Yeah. I mean, I think he frustrates me more than any player, any key player, in Pelicans, Hornets history. And I mean, David West, I know 42 around Jason Colmes is going to hate hearing me say this, but before Tyreke, it was David West's defense, especially the first couple of years. I never seen somebody give so little effort on that end and, you know, then still get mad at his teammates for getting beat.
Oh, no, come on. He unleashed some monster karate chops on defense.
I mean, he would stick the arm out and make it look like he was trying, and if he randomly got a ball or an arm, you know, it was good, but I've never seen somebody move their feet so little on the defensive end. But yeah, Tyreke in this role, late game role, like, you know, if he does well, I mean, he has won some games late for us, you know, and people seem to forget that and are quiet when he, you know, the Tyreke hero ball works. But yeah, I mean, he shouldn't be in that role, but he's kind of forced into it. Like, you know, we look at the Phoenix game, and it was a pick and roll with him and Ajinsa, and, you know, you saw Monty say pass the ball on the timeout. Phoenix guarded it well, and Tyreke got a little 8-10 footer and just missed it. But what are your other options there? You're going to give the ball to Norris Cole, who just dribbled out the clock a couple possessions earlier and hoisted up a 20 footer that almost got blocked and almost missed, you know, absolutely everything. I don't think that this is the ideal role for him. So yeah, he looks terrible, but with a full team, I still contend that we would have seen, if anybody wants to see what our team would actually look like, go back and watch the Memphis game in January, the game before Drew gets hurt. That's what our team would have looked like, and that would have been Tyreke off the bench playing at 100 miles an hour and not with the ball in his hands playing hero ball at the end of a fourth quarter. So in this role, yes, he is. I mean, he'll drive you crazy, and the team will win in spite of him more than because of him. But I do think that there is a role for him on this team if completely healthy. It's just not the role he's playing now.
Right. Yeah, I mean, that was like my whole take. Like, even Mark Stein in his power rankings is like, well, we see that Anthony Davis just isn't getting the ball enough because of this article where, you know, obviously Tyreke's getting it out too much. And I'm just kind of like, I'm kind of just over that. Like, you can sit here and tell me that Tyreke Evans has the ball in his hands too much and he makes bad decisions sometimes and it hurts the team. And I would say, no shit. But what's your other option right now? Like, have you seen Eric Gordon try to dribble? There's, you're not going to get a better outcome with Eric Gordon driving than Tyreke Evans driving. And the only other guy who would be a better option has been on the bench for most of the season because he keeps hurting himself. And the idea that, oh yeah, we should get the ball to Anthony Davis more often. Like, this is the funniest part about that is like, Anthony Davis receiving the ball at the end of games, other than that one driving layup that he moved quick on against San Antonio, what is the big shot that he takes that he hits it, but what's the shot he takes? A mid-range jumper, usually with a guy nearby him. This isn't a great shot. You shouldn't be gunning for that. You don't give the ball to Anthony Davis and clear out and make him operate. That doesn't really work that well. I mean, Davis is great in motion, receiving the ball and then cleaning stuff up and then hitting mid-range jumpers. Like, this isn't a guy you can give the ball to and say, create for everybody, and then have him dribble into some sort of awesome play. So I'm just, it's such a shallow thing just to go in there and look at the number of shots Evans is taking and the number of shots Davis is taking and saying, Monty Williams is a crappy coach because Tyreek Evans gets too many shots. It's just, it's a name.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to the article once OKC starts losing of how Kyle Singler is ruining the team and shooting too much. But, you know, Kevin Durant is away, and now Singler has to come in and replace him. I mean, I just, this narrative of how the Pelicans are disappointing or how they could be better, I rarely ever hear any of these national guys talk about just the overwhelming injuries with this team. And, you know, you'll never hear them stop crying about Oklahoma City's injuries, but I don't know. It's frustrating, and this was, you know, something that I really wanted to tackle this week because, you know, we could try to evaluate this team, and you and I come on this podcast and we evaluate this team and this game and that game and then predict this game and that game, but, like, we really have never seen what this team is. You know, it's been something that was put together over the last two seasons, and we really haven't seen it play together. And the second it starts to, you know, this injury occurs, that injury occurs, and it's not just about the injury and the next guy up. It's giving a different role to every single player. So, you know, two or three injuries occur, and you're really changing out 8 to 10 positions because everybody's moving into a new slot. You know, literally nobody is what they were the game before, and you're just trying to get by game instead of building a collective unit for the long term. So it's a frustrating thing, but, you know, I know we're coming off of 3 straight losses in this podcast. I still think that you got to give this team a lot of props for competing, you know, given all the injuries and the fact that these guys haven't had a training camp together and there's no continuity. I still think that, you know, it's not a season that I am happy with emotionally as a fan, but if we were told all these situations, if we were told, hey, in a must-win, a virtual must-win game for your playoff lives, the Pelicans will be starting Norris Cole, Quincy Pondexter, Dante Cunningham, Alexi Ajinsa, and Anthony Davis. Imagine if we were told that in October. Like, we would think that whoever told us that was drunk or high or, you know, just plain crazy. Like, seriously, think about what we would have thought if somebody would have told us that in October, and yet this...
And that we were only going to lose 7-7 to a fantastic team.
Right, and might not, I mean, and that we would be playing 5-on-8 that game because the refs would see some phantom goaltends and, you know, flopping garbage and whatever. Yeah, so, I mean, whatever, we're all stuck in this moment, but I want everybody on this podcast to really try to come to terms and think of their October 2014 selves. And really, if somebody had told them that, you know, they would just think they were absolutely insane. So, it's been a crazy season, but I still think that there's far more good that's come out of it as far as on the court. Now it's just about resolving these injury issues, hopefully long term.
Well, I also wanted, while we're doing this, and this is just, I think this is just me venting against, you know, just the national narratives that are happening right now, because they're starting to just tick me off. Like, the New Orleans Pelicans are 37-33. after going through another bad stretch with horrible injuries. They are over 500. There is a team in the Eastern Conference that people still talk about as a potential title contender if they can just get their injuries under control. Like, it's so unfair that they have all these injuries, but they're still a really good team and have all these great guys. I mean, I'm talking about Chicago. Chicago is, you know how many, like, this is a team that people still consider a good team. Do you know how many more losses the Pelicans have than Chicago? Four. They've lost four more games over the course of the season. Like, they talk about, like, Washington, like, it's a future contender. They have a one-point differential, and they've been mostly healthy. Milwaukee is a great story, and they're way worse than the Pelicans. Like, how are the Pelicans, like, continuously dismissed, and, like, every article you read about them is futility and badly put together and all this crap, when they're in the nastiest, brutalest, most knockdown, vicious conference I've ever seen, and they have a winning record. And they don't have their team most of the time. It doesn't make any sense to me. It annoys me.
We've got to trap all these national guys. Like, we got to shout, like, flowery praise at them and tell them to come on the podcast and then just, you know, sit them down and ambush them. Just turn full heel. I agree. And then you look at a team like Toronto, who is another team that's up there, third seed right now in the East. And the Pelicans have a much better record against 500 plus teams than Toronto. I fully agree. I think, you know, I'm always cautious about being a homer on this podcast. I don't like, you know, us just lifting up the good. I mean, there's obviously some bad here. This is not a perfectly put together team. We don't have a coach that we know for sure, you know, could lead us to the next level. Most people say there's no chance. I say there's probably a small chance. You know, we don't really know what's going on with ownership, and, you know, there's a big issue that I don't know about you. We've never really discussed it on this podcast, but it kind of scares me having this, you know, this big issue between the owner and his family kind of getting played out in the court of public opinion and eventually coming to a head. I mean, there are things here to worry about. I don't think the panic is ever as much, you know, as maybe nationally some people do. I mean, I look up and down the Western Conference, and if I had to be completely honest and I say, all right, Mike, you get to heed control of a franchise for the next 10 years, the only team that I might take over New Orleans is Golden State. I don't really think that there's another team I would even consider. I think that this team still is in position to have the brightest or second brightest future in this Western Conference. So I guess I'm just not as worried as most.
You're not going for Gobert and Hayward in Utah?
Yeah, I mean, that was a nice little stretch. I've watched the NBA long enough to see teams have nice little stretches over the second half of the year, and people think that's going to carry over, you know, and it doesn't. And they're even slowing down already now. But no, I wouldn't. I would be really tempted with Minnesota if they get the number one pick, or, you know, a good pick this year. There's a couple. I think there's three, maybe four guys I like in this draft. So if they pick the right one to put with Wiggins, you know, you could start to talk to me about Minnesota eventually, but no, that's about it.
I don't know. I would take Sacramento and DeMarcus Cousins every day.
Of course. but anyway, I mean, a couple games to talk about. I'd like to touch on them, but I'm more excited about what's going on moving forward. I said it the day of the game, you know, so I'm not saying this after the fact. You and I think we both expected a 1-2 road trip. I think you thought the Clippers game, or no, the Warriors game. You picked a weird one.
I was actually And I kind of mentioned this on Twitter. I was actually trying to do the reverse jinx.
Oh, okay.
Because I thought we didn't really have a chance to win in Phoenix and in Golden State, and I was hoping we could bookend it with some wins.
Well, I mean, conventional wisdom, convention, but I mean, realistically, if we had to bet, we were thinking the Phoenix game, right?
Yeah. So actually, I wasn't too confident with the Phoenix game just because we were in their house, and they're supposed to, like, if there was ever going to be like a last gasp that was going to be from that team to try to make a game of it, they were going to come out pretty hard against the Pelicans. But of course, I didn't expect us to be going in there with essentially one and a half of our top six functioning. So, right. I mean, Phoenix is just objectively probably the most likely other than Milwaukee.
Yeah, I mean, I guess we could start in the Milwaukee game. Even though that was a win, people always talk about the games the Pelicans should have won. I think that this was objectively one that they definitely could have and should have lost. I mean, the second quarter was just absolutely brutal. And then I think the thing that people will remember most is Ilyasova had a wide open look as you could possibly get at the end of the game to win it. The ball rattles in and out, and New Orleans escapes the game with a victory. But there wasn't a ton good there. I thought Ashik played fantastic. I was actually really happy with Coupon too, but nothing else kind of out of that game left me feeling really good. I thought our bench, which was, you know, a theme that we've been seeing lately, was pretty horrible. Yeah. And, you know, Milwaukee's length gave us a lot of problems. You know, it was a game that we won. It was at home against a team that is pretty bad on the road and has been awful since the All-Star break. So I don't know, you know, leaving this game, I didn't take much out of it positively other than they had escaped with a win, and you take every win you could get here. But I thought that they played better in the loss against the Clippers than they did in the win here against Milwaukee.
Yeah, it was an ugly physical game all around, and Davis was getting hammered all over the place and no calls. And Giannis has already, I think he's been watching James Harden clips and just has figured out how to barrel into somebody and then act like he'd been fouled as he throws up a shot. He's getting very good at that. I don't know. I think this game was perfectly summed up by one moment, and it was Ilyasova takes a shot, it rims out, and Tyreke Evans grabs the rebound, turns around as the buzzer, and Tyreke Evans, quite possibly one of our worst defensive players, looks at Anthony Davis like he's like he has no idea what's going on, and he goes, "What happened?" So, like, our worst defensive player is asking one of our best defensive players, how did that possibly happen? Like, there was no communication. It was just confusing. You didn't know what happened out there in that whole game. Like, how is this happening? Why are we missing so many shots? Why is Anthony Davis being mugged? It was just a confusing game. The only thing that felt right to me was how crappily Michael Carter Williams played.
Yeah, there you go. On that last play, I watched it enough times to break my DVR, and I would put the majority of the blame on Dante Cunningham.
Yes.
He loses his guy, and it causes Ashik steps over and basically prevents a layup that would have driven us all nuts for the win. If Ashik doesn't come off of his guy to cover for Cunningham, it's a layup and Milwaukee wins and we're all ripping out our hair. So I would say it was mostly Cunningham. It was also a well-designed play, and also a little bit of it goes to an illegal screen. So a couple of different things there, but whatever. They escaped with a win, but I don't think you could be feeling too good after this game. Even Anthony Davis in the interview right after the game seemed pretty upset. But I think the thing that worried me the most, just moving forward, was was the bench play. Again, we were all excited about some guys coming back and then some of the other players being able to provide some firepower off the bench or to, you know, just make the bench stronger. And really, they've just been pretty bad over these last couple of games. And specifically, I don't want to pick on the guy because he's been, you know, he's tried as hard or put as much effort out there as anybody else on this team. But Dante Cunningham has really struggled. He's obviously come back down to earth. And he's still going to give you hustling, and he's going to give you some defense, but he's just somebody that probably takes more shots than he should. He's the guy that's getting the open look, so I guess you got to pull the trigger. But he's basically become Jason Smith, but with a worse jump shot. You look at, he's shooting 42%. Since the All-Star break, is an offensive rating of 92 and a defensive rating of 107. That's bad for those of you who don't know those metrics. I mean, those are both bad numbers. So I don't know. He was a guy that definitely pulled us through some tough times. But we always wondered, is he just looking good because he's replacing Solomons and some of the other guys, and lately he's been pretty bad for this team, and the bench has as a whole as well.
Yeah. And I also think that Jensen might be having a little bit of the finally he's in a scouting report effect as well. Because I think you remember when Jason Smith first joined the team, he had like a 15-game stretch at the very beginning with the Hornets at the time, where he looked like he was frickin' unstoppable. Like, nobody knew how to guard his mid-range jumper, and when they ran out at him, he would run, drive by and dunk, and it felt like we had our big third big man. He was amazing. And then he started showing up in other team scouting reports, and suddenly most of what he did was taken away until he could figure out ways to counter it. And it took him like a good couple months before he could start being effective again. I think Agents is starting to feel that kind of thing as well. He's not really catching the ball necessarily where he likes it anymore, and guys are aggressively bodying him when he's trying to get position, and he's not quite strong enough to hold off against some of the more powerful defenders in the league. So
yeah, but he's got the dream shake.
He does. He's got a lot of moves.
It's hard to watch them. I mean, I watched Hakeem Olajuwon in his prime, and I still to this day do not think there was more beautiful basketball. I love Jordan, respect him, we'll call him the greatest. Shaq and his power was fantastic. Kobe in his prime was silky smooth. LeBron is like nobody else I've ever seen. But there has never been more beautiful basketball, in my opinion, than Hakeem Olajuwon in his prime. And Ajinsa tries to do some of the same moves, and it's, you know, it's like me trying to imitate Usher dancing. It's just, it's scary looking. I mean, there were some air balls this week on those fadeaways. I'd be happier if, maybe if he got low position, I don't mind him playing back to the basket. I like the mid-range jumpers, but this idea of dumping the ball down to him in the post and clearing out and letting him create his own offense, I'm not the biggest fan of that.
I have one thing I think would help him tremendously. It has to do with injuries and everything, but Luke Babbitt, I think being out there with Ajinsa actually helps him tremendously, because Ajinsa is a willing passer. And if you could put Babbitt out there as a stretch shooter, or Anderson, if he'd ever start playing basketball again. Babbitt out there as a stretch shooter, and then have one guy who's willing to make hard cuts, because Ajinsa can pick out guys who are cutting hard, and he can find the open man on the perimeter when he's not getting exactly what he needs. Right now, basically, he's being told to go out there and just score. Like, you're not going to get any other help. You're out there, and that's what you need to do, is you get the ball and you try to score. And if he could be more of a little bit more of a hub, I think it would help him, and he would see a lot less nasty of a defense that's focused on him.
Yeah, I like a Jensen the pick and roll game with Gordon. I mean, when he throws down a dunk, they look absolutely powerful and they get the bench off their feet. So off their feet. Yeah, on their feet, off their feet, whatever. But
it knocks them over. It was so powerful.
Yeah, they do something. But this Phoenix game, I mean, the hardest part watching that game was just personally, I felt like we didn't have the firepower to put us over the top. It always felt like it was a game we were going to just come up short, but it was still simultaneously maddening because you know if Anthony Davis doesn't roll a freaking ankle that morning, this is a blowout win. You know, it puts the Pelicans on the pace we thought they would be on in this road trip, even if they lose the last two, and it probably knocks the Suns out of contention for the playoffs where you know, they're just demoralized and done. It would have given us the tiebreaker over them and everything. And it was so frustrating watching this game because Eric Bledsoe looked disinterested at stretches. He was not himself. I know he grabbed 11 rebounds, but offensively he just wasn't as much in attack mode and his jumper was off. So he was very guardable. Marcus Morris, I mean, you know, the Morris brothers usually kill us in this game. They go 6 for 26, 0 of 8 from 3. So, you know, it was right there for the taking, served up to us, but just didn't have the firepower. Had a chance, obviously, late, down 1. Couple of, you know, obviously people bashed Monty for how it went down at the end there, but Tyreek just missed another shot, shot just 4 of 16 on the night. Ajinsa clearly got fouled trying to go up for the rebound, something the NBA would later admit. But, you know, it just wasn't a game that I felt the Pelicans on any level had the firepower to win. You know, it was just frustrating because it was hard to imagine what this game would have been with Anthony Davis. I mean, other people will look back on the season if the Pelicans miss the playoffs by one game and think of the New York game, the Philly game, whatever game against X bad team. This will honestly be the game that I'll think about because, you know, a rolled ankle to me will be what I think of as what cost us the playoffs, if we miss by one game.
Yeah, I wouldn't even pin it entirely on Anthony Davis's rolled ankle and shoot around. Like, if Tyreek Evans doesn't go down in the second quarter and loses all ability to shift gears in the second half, I think he might have been just that little bit. I mean, I'm certain that he would have been able to finish two more of his 16 shots. Like, and that's the game. So, yeah. I don't know.
I mean, you're trying to find a player who really played well for the Pelicans, and you're really struggling in this game. That tells you how bad Phoenix played as well. I thought our defense was fine, but I thought Phoenix scoring 74 points was more on them than us. But, yeah, it's a game that I think will be the one that frustrates me the most just because of so many things that were at stake and knowing that you now had the next two games on the road. That Golden State game was practically unwinnable going into it. I would have, if it were allowed and it were not considered cowardly, the way that golfers in match play kind of give their opponent the gimme putt and allow them to pick up the ball, I would have done that against Golden State. I would have just said, all right, pick up the win. We'll take the loss and we'll just fly straight through to LA for a rest and relaxation day. So that was what was so frustrating about this Phoenix game is I felt that if the team really had a chance at a 1-2 road trip, which is what you and I were both hoping for, this was the game and a freaking rolled ankle. And then, like you said, Tyreek getting banged up and then Omer getting banged up. You know, really.
And actually, like I was saying before, the reason why we lost the game was because Tyreek Evans. But, like, if Ashiq had been able to play that whole game, he was eating them alive out there. Like, they could not get a rebound when he was on the court. He was really impactful on that, and he was guarding their pick and roll better than anybody else on our team.
Yeah.
So frustrating.
Yeah, no, I mean, Ashiq was on pace for, you know, minimum 20 rebounds that night. So, yeah, it's whatever. What can you say about it's frustrating? The Golden State game, I don't really think.
I don't even want to talk about the Golden State. I mean, they didn't have a chance. Evans sat, you know, it was just.
The only thing I do want to talk about that is I was furious that Tyreke Evans played in that game.
At all.
Yeah, like, why? I mean, he's banged up. It's the second night of a back-to-back. I know coaches don't like to think like this, and it's bad for the culture or whatever, but sometimes you have to be a realist. There was a 0% chance the Pelicans were winning that game. If you have a guy banged up, there's no way you play, especially when you got another huge game two nights from now in L.A., which, by the way, Tyreke didn't play in. Because his ankle, quote unquote, stopped responding to the treatment. I'm sure the 15 minutes against Golden State didn't help. I saw no reason to play this game. This was the game to put Jimmer Fredette and, you know, get your money's worth out of Elliot Williams. Send Elliot Williams out there for 35 minutes. Let him earn his paycheck before you cut him. There's nothing to talk about X and O wise about the Golden State game. I was just really upset that Monty decided to play Tyreke. I saw absolutely no point in that.
Yeah, on some hands, I can see, like, if a guy's, like, always willing to play, just saying, all right, go ahead. But, you're right. Like, he should have just said, Evans, just sit. Just, there's no reason. But, you know, That game was such a mess anyways. You're right. He should not have played. I will agree with you. Now let's go on to the Clippers game before I have to think more about the Golden State game, which I just kind of watched with a sour look on my face the entire game and then turned it off about halfway through the fourth quarter.
I don't know what they're... First of all, I wish we brought our three-point shooting over from Clippers games to every other game. It seems like we're just red hot against them every time.
Might be because their perimeter defense sucks, but...
Yeah, but, I mean, we can't make open shots against other teams. It's not like when the threes we miss against Denver is because they're right in our grill. We miss open ones against everybody else. How do we hit them against the Clippers?
Yeah, just maybe they're up for it.
Again.
Maybe they're like, yeah, they hate Chris Paul. Like, I remember some games that I would 100% lay at the foot of Chris Paul's big mouth that we lost. Like, Jose Calderon was a fine point guard for a lot of years. But whenever he and Paul got on the court together, whatever Paul said to Calderon would just piss him off. Like, his entire demeanor changed. He actually started playing defense, which is something he didn't do normally. He would be out there, like, talking smack, pointing his finger in people's faces, just going after them. And I wouldn't that really shock you if, like, Chris Paul's mouth didn't just annoy the crap out of the Pelicans at some point?
I feel like it was the same against Houston. I feel like Kyle Lowry, when he was with Houston, hated Chris Paul.
Yes. Absolutely, I agree with that. And they just seemed like they would put it in another gear because it was just something about CP.
Yeah, and Eric Gordon obviously having the motivation going back to LA now. It seemed like he was late for a team meeting, I guess is what we heard, but he comes off the bench, goes 5 of 8 from deep, scores 23 points on 13 field goals.
I think you should always come off the bench.
Yeah.
That's what I learned from this. He should always be on the bench.
I mean, it's not the worst strategy in the world. I mean, the problem with it, however, if there's no Tyreke, then you got Norris Cole running the offense. And I mean, how many times do you think in the last couple of years we've had New Orleans point guard with a 6 turnover and 6 personal foul game.
I would say zero.
Yeah, I would agree.
I can't remember the last time I've seen both of those wonderful feats accomplished.
Yeah.
I mean, it's unfair putting Norris Cole in there against Chris Paul, though. Let's be 100% real here. Like, Norris Cole is a backup point guard for a reason. Putting him up against Chris Paul is pretty much just, you know, setting the table for Chris Paul's feast.
I agree, but I still think at this level, turnovers are preventable with, you know, just a certain level of focus. I mean, what was that turnover with Dante Cunningham in the backcourt where he threw, like, some garbage, you know, over his shoulder behind the back pass that got picked off for a layup? Do you remember? That was – but I guess, you know, I don't want to call people out, but I could – it's very easy for me to tell when I get tweeted at and mentions or talk on message boards – who actually watched the game and who just came by and looked at the box score. And I got to admit, if I just look at the box score and didn't watch the game, I see Anthony Davis with 13 shots scoring 26 points. I see Dante Cunningham with 13 shots scoring just 8 points. And in my mind, I go, wow, Monty's an idiot. How does he drop, you know, have shots for Cunningham? The same amount as Anthony Davis. Monty's got to go. For those who watch the game, if you want to represent us who watch the game, how would you respond to that critique? I mean, why do you think, even though, you know, despite the fact Davis was 3 times as efficient, Davis and Cunningham ended up with the same number of shots?
Because Dante Cunningham was being left wide open and he was taking the open shots. I mean, they moved the ball, found the wide open guy, and Dante Cunningham was it. Or he was finding garbage. I mean, there's no way in hell I'm going to sit here and say that Dante Cunningham on any of his shots, was he the first option or the second option or the third option?
Yeah, I mean, but so just to run counter to that, you will never see a game in which, you know, unless it's part of the game plan for some reason, but you'll never see a game where, gosh, I don't know, Tristan Thompson takes as many shots as LeBron James, or Mitch McGarry takes as many as Russell Westbrook, or insert right. this player that. I mean, yeah, as a philosophy, you want the open guy who gets the ball to take the shot and not hesitate and think about it. But, you know, if you just do that and you don't force your main guy, teams will respond to that and you'll have games in which Cunningham gets as many shots as Davis. Is there still something that we could do, or is there a way that Davis has to force the action more, or the guards have to force it to Davis more, or is this just something where the open guy is going to get the shot, and if Cunningham happens to take as many shots as Davis, so be it?
You're asking my opinion?
Yeah.
I actually kind of enjoyed watching the offense in that game. I thought they moved the ball appropriately. I mean, it is unfortunate that we have a player like Dante Cunningham on the floor who can't finish. But I think Davis was making correct basketball plays through most of that game. I mean, he had 5 assists, and he moved when he was supposed to. And I mean, he's not amazing at sealing people off and getting the correct position in the paint. So you got to move the ball around a whole lot. And if the other team knows that the other players on the court are Dante Cunningham, Alexis Ajinsa, Norris Cole, and Quincy Pondexter, you're going to give a little bit more attention to him, and he needs to move the ball if the team wants to make an open shot. Like, does anybody remember what he did in Kentucky? He took the 4th most shots on that team?
I think it was 5th, yeah.
I mean, he plays smart team basketball, and if somebody's going to kill Anthony Davis for that, they're a moron.
How many assists do you think Anthony Davis is averaging over his last 5 games?
I'd say 4.
5.2 assists per game.
Nice.
How many games? So he's averaging 5.2. before this stretch, these last five games, in all the other games Davis played, how many five or more assist games do you think he had this year?
Well, I know it wasn't many because I remember he set a record with six, I think, for him. Like he set that at the beginning of this. So I would probably say one, two.
Zero.
None. Really?
So, okay. You know, he had no five assist games before this, you know, stretch. And now he has four games of five or more assists in these last five, and he's averaging 5.2 assists over these last five games. So something's going on here. I mean, he's passed, and it's not like his points, you know, are down. I mean, in
they're not suffering at all.
Yeah, he put up 43 points. He put up a 36 burger against Denver, 26 against the club. I mean, he's scoring as well. The only game he didn't score well in was that Brooklyn game, and that's because they were up by so much he didn't play. But yeah, I mean, it's a new part of his game that it looks like that he's adding, and you know, he continues to do that. Now he's just one or two moves away, working on his ball handling a little bit, and you know, maybe improving the range on his shot or his post up game. And this guy becomes a truly unstoppable offensive weapon. And yeah, if you actually put around, you know, around him guys who could finish, you know, it's going to be impossible to cover the Pelicans in the coming years.
All right, so let me hit you with this question. It doesn't happen very often. If I'm going to give you an over-under for his career, including playoffs, how many quadruple doubles over under two for his career?
So I could push. Can you give me over under 1.5?
Nope.
Can I push?
No, can't push. Got to pick one.
I think he's going to finish with two.
That's exactly what I was thinking. Like I mean, David Robinson was the last guy who did it. Like, what, I think it was 97. No, maybe it was 93. Somewhere else. Like, the guy's already a threat to do that with blocks, assists, rebounds, and points in any game. And like, we've even seen him have like six steal games. Like, could he be the first quintuple double? Would it be like unbelievable that could happen?
I think he could have two quadruple doubles. And the fourth category will be different.
That's true.
So, yeah, I think he could be the first guy to ever do that. And the thing I like about his stats is they just come within the flow of the game. It's nothing being forced. He's not consciously making an effort to rack up assists or get points or steal rebounds from other players. You know, he's quite simply the best overall player on the court almost every time he steps on it, and the stats just tend to come from it. So,
and you did bring this up. We do have to give Monty Williams' offensive system some of the credit for this. Like, the passes he is making in these games to get his assists, like, inevitably there's one or two that he's just kicking it out to an outside shooter and that guy's jacking up a three-pointer. And those are the kinds of assists he used to be getting, was those kinds of passes. But every game it feels like there's one or two of those. It's just the play was executed perfectly and he found just the right bounce pass to just the right guy at just the right time. And it's because it was a really nice play. Like, he has to make the pass, and he has to be aware that he has to be making all the reads, which shows that he's a high basketball IQ. But, I mean, Monty is not running a vanilla pick-and-roll offense at all anymore, and if people haven't noticed that, they haven't been paying attention. And Davis is becoming the hub of that more and more, and it almost feels at times like it's almost a triangle offense they're running through him, and it's kind of fun to watch.
Yeah, and just imagine when he has better finish. I mean, imagine when he has Drew Holiday and Ryan Anderson instead of, I don't know, Norris Cole and Dante Cunningham. And he's making those same passes to those guys. You know, good luck. So, yeah, it's been good to see another thing he's added to his game. But, yeah, this was a tough stretch. I fully expected the Warriors and Clippers ones. The Phoenix one just, it really hurts, and it's going to continue to hurt. And, you know, it kind of put Phoenix in a position where, you know, they got some momentum back and some hope, and now they've actually sprung ahead of the Pelicans as of this podcast by a half a game, but still a half a game nonetheless, and their schedule turns brutal, so I'm not too worried about them finishing ahead of the Pels, but it's something where they could have just put Phoenix away. You know, they could have put themselves in a better position right now for this playoff run, so that one hurt the most, but we got to move on. We've got what I consider 5 very winnable games coming up in this next 5, and the Pels just got to take advantage.
Yep. So before our next podcast, we're going to have 3 games. So we're going to talk. I'll tell you the full 5, and then we'll just focus on those 3. The 5 games you're talking about are at home versus Houston, at home versus Sacramento, at home versus Minnesota, and then on the road against Los Angeles and Sacramento again. So let's just talk about the first 3, though. So you seem to think that on Twitter you were saying that if we can win the game at home against Houston on Wednesday night, you feel pretty comfortable about being able to land in the playoffs. I don't know how comfortable I feel about that, because Russell Westbrook is leading OKC to wins against some teams that they probably shouldn't be winning against. They've been pretty impressive, just the amount of points they're scoring right now. So I'm not sure even if we do play really well, we're going to be able to get in, because they do control their own destiny at this point. But you think that if they take the Houston game, you don't expect to see some sort of letdown against Sacramento or Minnesota or in L.A.?
Well, let me ask you this. How long do you think it's been since Oklahoma City beat a +500 team on the road?
Well, I'm sure you're going to drop some sort of thing like 17 years. So I'll go 2 weeks.
It was us way back on February 4th, that game before the Anthony. I mean, it always feels this way. People are just victims of recency bias. There's nothing you could do about it. And, you know, it's completely understandable, but it feels like Oklahoma City is playing so well. They're doing exactly what we did a couple of weeks ago when I told everybody to pump the brakes and not get too excited. They are beating teams at home shorthanded, and, you know, they're doing what they're supposed to. I mean, even the games they played recently, Atlanta, of course they conveniently get them without Kyle Korver. The Celtics, you know, they're the Celtics, first of all. Get them without Isaiah Thomas. The Bulls, they get at home without both Rose and Jimmy Butler. I mean, I see a bunch of wins here at home, just like we did. You look at their recent road games. They've only played 2 road games, you know, in the last 10, and they were both losses at Dallas, at Chicago. People act like they're playing so good. They're really not. They're winning at home, which they should do, but they're not going to be at home much longer. They get one more cupcake game at home against the Lakers, and then they go 4 of their next 5 are at San Antonio, at Utah, at Phoenix, at Memphis. And, oh, by the way, the other 3 games that they have in their next 7 are Houston, San Antonio, and Dallas. Even though those are at home, those are much better teams than they've been beating lately. So I'm not on board with thinking that OKC is playing so well. I could easily see them going 2-5 or even 1-6 in that 7-game stretch. So I guess I'm just I'm completely sold on Russell Westbrook. I bow down to what he's been doing these last couple months, but as a team, I think they're doing exactly what we were doing a couple weeks ago, beating average teams at home, and now they've got to go on the road. And you saw what happened to us when we went on the road. So I'm not as on board as you are. So there's my little OKC rant.
I gotta say, last week you did kind of kick me in the nuts when you did when I was talking about, are they going to be really worried about OKC and the playoffs of Golden State? And you're like, yeah, we have one Anthony Davis, they have two. And I was like, yeah, you're right. Because like, everybody forgets now, if you look at the rankings, Westbrook and Durant in the NBA rank, they're in the top five, both of them.
Yeah, and they also now have gotten Enes Kanter, who's, you know, the man, the myth, the legend. This guy's, I looked up in the first quarter against Miami, and the guy had like 17-9. Like, give me a freaking break. It's Enes Kanter, but of course, and Anthony Morrow is killing us. As much as I loved him last year, I'm starting to hate him this year. Just sports hate, not real life hate. But
the weird thing about it, though, is like, we saw what Anthony Morrow did last year. He is a capable offensive player in more ways than just shooting. Like, why was he not playing more for that team? Like, they're desperate for like a reliable perimeter shooter. I just don't get why it took like half the season for them to realize, hey, we might have a guy who can do some offensive stuff off the bench over here.
He's no Andre Roberson.
That's true. He's not.
So, yeah, I do think the Houston game is big. I didn't say they'd make the playoffs. I said if the Pelicans win the game against Houston, we will be back in the eighth seed by April 3rd, which, by the way, for all you movie aficionados out there, is the date that Furious 7 comes out. So we could both be back in the eighth spot and watching Dom, Brian O'Connor, and the rest of the crew tear it up in Fast and Furious 7. So if that's not a banner day, I have no clue what one is.
How does that franchise get to 7 movies?
Oh, you got to watch. 5 and 6 are amazing.
Well, I'll say I watched the first two.
I promise you, sit down and watch 5 and 6 with an open mind. I do not like action movies, but they're fantastic. But speaking of fantastic, I got a little ambush for you. March 25th, at home against the Rockets. I think it's a big game. It's also huge because it is rapper Juvenile's 40th birthday. Hopefully the Pelicans do the right thing, bring him to the Smoothie King Center, celebrate his birthday, leave there with a win. But I am going to give you 4 songs right now. And it's going to be really easy. All you're going to have to do is tell me which one is not a Juvenile song. Are you ready for this?
All right, go ahead.
So we've got A, Flossin' Season, B, Ice Cream Paint Job, C, Huh, and D, Off Top. Which one is not a Juvenile song?
C, Ha.
No, that is actually one of his biggest, probably his second biggest song ever. So that is a Juvenile song. The answer I was looking for is Ice Cream Paint Job, which is it is a fabulous song in its own right, but it does not belong to the canon.
Who did Ice Cream Paint Job?
I really should know this. It's the,
see? I'm not the only loser around here.
I never really did anything afterwards. And I know he starts off the song with, like, it's the T-O-double-T. I have no clue. Duro. So, whatever. I got stumped on that one, but it is a song that I bump. I should know it. He starts right off. It's the D-O-double-R. But whatever. That is not a Juvenile song. The other three, I definitely think that you should listen to as we prepare for Juvenile's 40th birthday. And perhaps to get serious, I think maybe the most important game of this Pelican season. You can't lose four in a row. You win that one. You know, you have four, I wouldn't say cupcakes, but probably the four of the easiest games coming down the stretch you're going to have. I really think that this has to be a 4-1 or 5-0 stretch to really, you know, really to have any hope. So I think that Houston game is close to a must win. You could win the other four and still be in decent position, but I think that's a big game for the Pelicans. And, yeah, I do truly believe if they win that one that they'll head in, you know, at the end of April 3rd, they will be sitting there in the eighth spot. So I do not think all hope is lost yet.
So here's the question for you. James Harden has been picking up his game and playing pretty well recently. With Drew Holiday not available, I don't think the Pelicans have really anybody who can guard him. So which would you rather the Pelicans decide to do? Throw everything they can, the kitchen sink, help defenders, everything at James Harden, and stop him from being able to get to the rim and score? And if the rest of the Rockets pick us apart and kill us, so be it. Or would you rather try to just contain all the rest of the Rockets, and if James Harden gets his, he gets his, and leave like Norris Cole on an island against him? Which would you prefer?
I saw Indiana to an extent try that strategy with Harden tonight, and it just didn't work. Harden went off for 44, and Houston won. I think you've got to hope that he's missing his contested jumpers on the night. You know, you've got to frustrate him, but you also got to be conscious of the shooters that are around. Maybe you leave Josh Smith open and hope he doesn't go 4-for-6 like he did for tonight. But I don't think it's a one or another thing. I think you got to stay balanced. I actually don't mind Tyreek on James Harden just because we saw that he's more invested when he's on ball. You know, if he could just stop with the reaching and, you know, just kind of go vertical when James Harden tries to draw the fouls that he inevitably will. But I play a little bit of a more balanced game. I don't think that I just let Harden get his and try to take everybody else out. Because I've seen games where Harden could just put up 45-50 you know, win it by himself. I think the main thing is keeping him off the free throw line. I mean, he had 22 free throws tonight, which is just absolutely insane. And like we've talked about before, not only do you give up points, but you get guys in foul trouble. And when you have a shortened bench because of all the injuries, you know, you can't do that. And it also gets the team into the bonus quicker. So other guys are getting to the free throw line. I think that's the main thing, is just make him shoot contested shots. If he makes them, that's fine, but you can't just send him to the line all day.
Yeah. Yeah. I agree with you 100% that, I mean, people used to, like, the Spurs were famous for when they played Phoenix. What they would do is just try to stop all the other dudes on those Phoenix teams and let Steve Nash shoot. If he wants to shoot, go right ahead. And people are always like, well, that feels like it's kind of crazy, because Steve Nash is one of, like, the charter members of like Steph Curry. His numbers this year are worse than Steve Nash's numbers when he played in Phoenix. That's how good of a shooter Steve Nash actually was for those years in Phoenix when that team was a top team. So you kind of feel like it's suicide to let a guy who's that good take those shots. But the difference was Steve Nash, when he had to take lots of shots, he wasn't getting them through free throws at all. It was all shooting. And he was hitting threes here and there, but his actual efficiency numbers went down. He was not as good of a points per shot kind of guy when he was taking all the shots, because he wasn't getting the open looks he wanted. And and he wasn't basically feeding off of all the other guys cutting and making baskets and making his job easier. Harden, like, he is not Steve Nash. This is a guy who they give the ball to, and Harden invents something with it. And he is scoring 1.493 points per shot this season. That is insane. Like the only person I've ever seen beat that number who was a Hornet / Pelican was Tyson Chandler, and all he did was dunk. Like, this guy is a crazy efficient player, and everybody knows he is number one and the number two option on this team. He's absolutely sick.
Yeah, I mean, he is prone though to some bad games, I would say, mm-hmm. more than, you know, maybe somebody like Steph Curry, even though Curry had, you know, at least a bad half against us. You know, you saw PJ Tucker really give Harden problems the other night, and Tucker, you know, is a big physical guy who just didn't bite on a lot of the stuff. So I don't know. I think it's a winnable game. Obviously, absolutely blew him out here. It's interesting because it seems like Dwight Howard is coming back at some time this week. It could be Wednesday. It could be later in the week. I don't know how much of an effect that'll have. But then again, I have no clue who's playing for the Pelicans on Wednesday. And here we are. We're going to have to go and predict three games coming up. But neither of us have any clue who is playing in these games.
Yeah, we have no idea if Ashik's going to be there. We have no idea if Tyreke Evans is going to be there. Actually, let me change that. I think Evans is probably going to be there. He does play hurt. So I have a feeling if he can at all go, he's going to try to make himself go.
And I would assume the same with Ashik, because Tyreke was ruled out of the game earlier against the Clippers. Ashik was a game-time decision, so it seemed like he was even closer than Tyreke in the Clippers game. So. And I'm sure Ashik would love to play against Houston, especially if Dwight is back even for a couple of minutes. But, I think it's, you know, and we keep talking about playoffs, but I think a really interesting thing here, there's a lot of little things that the Pelicans could accomplish in these last 12 games that aren't even playoffs. I mean, winning a season series against Houston would be pretty nice, right?
Yeah.
Or what about even sweeping it? That's still in play. You know, it's still in play for them to win the season series against San Antonio and Memphis. Like, it would be really nice to go 11-5 or 10-6 against the Southwest Conference and win three out of the four season series. I think, you know, I know this is crazy, but I think with health next year, I mean, I right now standing out, obviously having no idea what the teams are going to do, I would consider the Pelicans and the Rockets as co-favorites for this division next year. I don't know. I mean, I guess I'm never truly a believer in Memphis, and I guess we'd have to see what they're going to do, but I just see them as getting older. You know, either they overpay Jeff Green or they let him leave. I see these as the two teams that I would say are most likely to win the Southwest Division next year. So I think there's a lot of little things that could still be accomplished in these final 12. You know, seeing Drew Holiday back on the court, even if it's only for 3 to 5 games, would make the month for me. So, there's more than just playoffs, and a win here against Houston guarantees you win the season series against them, which I think is no small feat.
All right, then make the prediction. Three games, Houston, Sacramento, Minnesota, all at home. The Pelicans are going
3-0.
Wow.
3-0. Out of the other two, maybe this will fall in your prediction. What game are you more worried about, Sacramento or Minnesota?
Sacramento.
Why is that?
Because sometimes DeMarcus Cousins just goes nuts on the inside, and the Pelicans tend to, and like a Rudy Gay can have one of his crazy games, which is, I don't know, just something about Sacramento. It always feels like I want to like, oh, they suck. they're poo-poo, and then they come back in and just they somehow just keep going at the Pelicans, and the Pelicans just don't get their offense going. I feel less worried about it now than I used to, partly because, you know, Mike Malone is gone, and he actually had them clicking as a pretty solid defense when he's around, and that's all gone to hell. But I don't know. It always feels like the Pelicans play down to Sacramento.
Do you think either of those teams are going to start, how do you say this nicely, playing young players?
Tanking.
Yeah. Oh, okay. Sure. Yeah. Or are both of those teams still at the point where they're trying to win every game they step on the court?
I think Minnesota's been tanking for a while. They had so many injuries that they had to sign some dude who just happened to be in New York when they were there for a game. Sacramento, I don't know. George Karl probably is trying to install some of the stuff, so he's trying to see what, you know. I would be willing to bet that Karl right now is evaluating that roster and seeing what he's got before they go into the offseason so they can make whatever changes are necessary. I'm sure they're not trying super hard, but I have a feeling they're still going to play at least some of their players for a significant amount of time. Yeah. So, I don't know. I am also going with the 3-0 prediction. So.
Oh.
But you asked which one I was most worried about, and it was Sacramento.
All right. Well, good. Hopefully we'll be able to come on this podcast and hold our head high that our predictions came through. 3-0 would be nice. Be even nicer if Oklahoma City started dropping a couple of games. Maybe if the Lakers could help us out too and pull off another miracle, maybe Oklahoma City could fall even faster than we anticipate. So, yeah, 3-0 week from both of us. Bound to happen.
Yep. All right, so thanks, everybody, for listening to In the Know, and we'll be back in about a week.